This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Okie dokie, we are back. Honestly, I think it's really good, but Sherry thinks my trumpet is really shit.
We'll see if it makes the edit and then we'll know.
But when I did hear a proper trumpet the other day, I was like, well, probably because that was a real trumpet. Anyway, hello, Peter. Welcome.
Good afternoon, James.
How's your week been? What have you been up to?
That's a great question. This week has been incredibly exciting because it's been the Health and Safety Event Week. So this is the premier event. Other events are available. But this has very much been the event that has been kind of on my radar for the first half of this year. 3-day big event down in Birmingham, of which we were down there for two. And it has been busy. Oh, my God, it has been busy. My brain is just like depleted in terms of everything. Honestly, my social battery's drained from seeing everyone. My ability to absorb information has been drained. So honestly, James, we'll see if I can string together a coherent sentence through this. And let's see what happens, mate. See what happens. How about
your version of a non-coherent, that's ironic, isn't it? Non-coherent sentence is probably just a normal sentence.
Let me know in the comments afterward. Did you need a dictionary to understand what Pete said this episode?
They'll be like, oh, let's get Pete more tired more often and he'll use less fancy words.
That's it. It is literally my motto, James. Why use three words when five will do? That is literally.
I love it. I've been up to the same, really. So Monday I had a really nice call with Prakash Sengani from Safety AI. That was really cool. Just chewing the fat a little bit. And touching base with him because I haven't spoke to him since he was on the podcast, which was probably like, I don't know, maybe like 2 years ago, if not longer. It would have been longer because I wasn't consulting back then. So, yeah, it would have been. Then we went to the expo for the Tuesday, Wednesday. As you said, my social battery is truly gone because last night then I went to a Risk Talk, like safety tech networking thing that Risk Talk had put together. From Risk Talk had put it together. That was in a place that I don't think I belong. It was a very nice, wealthy little members club in London. The second I walked in, I was like, I do not belong here.
Big question is though, James, did you leave being able to play golf? Because that's the real litmus test.
I left not being able to walk home. I was not that drunk.
Do you know, I was wondering why Carly was doing that Koch assessment for a hangover cure. You know, it did seem like it had some interesting bits in it. It really did. Sorry, really putting the dynamic and dynamic risk assessments there, mate. I like it. I like it. Happy day. Do you know, it is really fun, isn't it? I love it.
Today has been relatively boring getting ready for Berlin, which is in 2 weeks. We're doing, I'm going to rub it in your face actually, Peter, because you can't come.
For reasons that will become clear on LinkedIn, I'm sure, at some point. But yes, I'm very jealous, very jealous. It looks like it's going to be insane. So good. Yeah.
And Rerun and Safety are doing three live interviews. For the podcast there, and we're just sorting logistics out for the three people, but we will be, as long as nothing goes wrong logistically wise, we should be interviewing the one and only Sydney Decker, Juliana Blay, and Jean-Christophe Lacoste.
Unreal.
So really nice lineup. So Sherry's designed a banner, and she took a picture of it. I put it on LinkedIn immediately, and then she moaned at me because it was just a shitty photo in our shitty living room, is what she said. I was just like, look, we'll just get the post out there. But with trying to logistically get all of our stand and podcast gear and us to Berlin is proving challenging. But that, in a nutshell, has been my week.
Beautiful. So, what a week! it is very much event season at the moment, and just kind of like going out and doing things. I appreciate that it wasn't this week, but last week it was great to have attended and spoken at the British Frozen Food Federation's Health and Safety Conference. Yeah. Down at the British Motor Museum. A huge fan of the BFFF and very appreciative of the opportunity. So thank you very much, Simon Brentnell, Rupert and the team over at the BFFF for the opportunity there. And certainly please do connect with Simon Brentnell if you haven't done already. And if you are in food, definitely reach out to the BFFF, a fantastic organisation with genuinely a lot of really progressive and practical safety work that they're doing. Mm. But mate, I mean, wow. BFFF, health and safety event, soireeing in London, Berlin at the end of the week. Good God, James, do we actually get any work done in this place? Genuinely.
No, we genuinely don't. I am drowning in work. Like, Sherry was like, what are you going to do today? And I'm like, try and catch up.
Like, literally try and catch up, yeah.
It is good going to do all that stuff and meeting everyone, but yeah, there's still work needs to be done.
That is the balance though, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, don't get me wrong, like Risfluen, we do some really solid work with some really big clients, but at the end of the day, we're not like a 30, 40 strong business type of stuff. If we're out of the business, you know, it's quite, we do have to kind of catch up. And I feel for a lot of small business owners and a lot of sole consultants that were coming out to these events over the last couple of weeks and while going out to Berlin, because the world doesn't stop for them. It literally doesn't stop. So well, do you know what? If you've gone and catching back up.
Yeah. And that so we're trying out this new style of this podcast. So basically what me and you are going to do is jump on camera once a week at the moment. We'll see how that goes. Are we going once a week or did we go once a...
Let's try once a week. Let's see how it goes.
I can't remember. Oh, we did once a month, didn't we? I don't know. No, I've just put one in. I don't know. We're going to regularly jump on there. Let's try once a week and see how it goes. But essentially, yeah, weekly. I was going to do it weekly. So essentially the plan is to try and get consistent podcasts again, but also make it less editing intensive, less planning intensive. As if we have a very simple agenda and we do like the weekly rebranding safety episode or whatever, where we come on, we go, what have you been up to this week? And as you can see, that's going to vary between, like, this week was all about networking and stuff like that, whereas most of our other weeks will be like, well, Peter's been working on this and Jen's been working on this. So I think people will get a nice insight of what we're doing and maybe what the life of a consultant looks like. And also, like, that might help them think about things that they could do to take some action and so on. And then we're going to move swiftly on to the next topic, which is what we've been thinking about this week. And then after we've done that towards the end of the episode, what we're going to do is take a question from the audience. So what we want to try and do as we kind of build with this and stay consistent with it, hopefully people send us in questions, we'll pick one of them random and we'll discuss it for like last 20 minutes of the show or whatever. So we currently have a backlog of about 20 questions that we need to address. So yeah, don't send too many in too soon. So bringing this quite nicely on from what you just said there about small business, that's kind of what I've been thinking about a lot this week, is that we're very lucky in Risfluen that we get to work with big, big brands, that, you know, huge international businesses or like large UK-based businesses. We're very lucky to be able to do that. But what I think makes us even more lucky is that we also get to work with really small businesses. So we tend to work with like the lower end of the medium size or the upper end of the small size of business. And to be able to see that small/medium-sized business and also the huge global monsters that are more like countries than they are companies, and compare the two, I find really interesting. But the one thing that has not been able to leave my head this week while sitting at the expo and listening to all of these things and then also going networking last night with predominantly big brands, was a bit of a safety as done, safety as imagined gap, I think. And I don't think it's a bit of a gap. I think it's a huge gap. I felt like everything we're talking about is very far removed from the world of a small business. And something like 80% of the British economy and the world economy is going to be small businesses, if not micro.
Oh yeah, SMEs are huge. Was it? I think it's, last time I checked, I want to say it was 5.5 million SMEs in the UK, small and medium enterprises, and they make up over 99% of the UK's private sector businesses in the UK. Like, it is, there is just an astronomical amount of these small and medium businesses that are churning out products, services every single day, bringing us on. And I'll be honest with you, 5.5 million businesses, how many of those do I think have good safety representation? Probably 1%. Probably 1%.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think they have the money, the resources to get someone, because what I see happening is that, which is a good thing, by the way, the safety professional being paid more, right? Which I think is a good thing. The value of the safety professional is increasing. And I think that's really nice to see. I wish it happened when I wasn't paying safety professionals myself, but hey ho.
I don't.
It's which I think is a really good thing, right? But ultimately, these small businesses, they can't afford it. So what they go to consulting, right? And then they end up in consulting, essentially, in like a bit of a race to the bottom. And I think there's a lot of questionable quality of work that's out there in the consulting world. And I'm not saying that as a competition point of view. I'm just saying I don't think it's the consultant's fault either. I think it's just the way the economy is working. Everything is cheaper, quicker, and we can't really do good quality safety cheaper and quicker, I don't think.
I totally agree. I mean, let's look at it. I think I could have sworn I saw a stat this week that said that the average salary for a SHE advisor is now £48,000.
Yeah. Which is great.
I could have sworn that I'd seen that. It's fantastic. Like, genuinely, absolutely fantastic. I mean, I started my career back in 2016 as career in safety. Well, I was an assistant health and safety manager. So that was down in Hilton Hotels, because literally anyone could just see my work experience on LinkedIn. And it was £24,000, literally like £24,000 a year for working in London, down in Park Lane. And don't get me wrong, like, at the time, I felt pretty thankful for being able to get £24,000 to do it. But at the same time, I could live in Zone 2 in Camberwell for £600 a month for a one-bedroom in a four-bedroom shared flat. And I had all my bills included, and I had a king-size bed in there. It was absolutely, it was a steal. It was an absolute steal. But I mean, geez, to say that in the space of less than a decade, that type of starting salary has probably doubled. Wow. Throw in inflation in there as well. Business rates. Hell, electricity and gas hasn't come down for a lot of brick and mortar businesses. Rising costs of insurance, rising costs of fuel. Suddenly having to pay, even let's say on the very cheap side of stuff, let's say someone gets someone really green in and we're looking at, like 36 type of thing, super green. That's still a lot. Still loads of money, and you've got development that's needed on top.
How much do you think? So I come into safety with no safety qualifications, so nothing. I was as green as green. I wasn't even green. I was like burnt yellow. You know, like when the grass hasn't been fed. That was the kind of green I was. Right. What do you think I was paid? I was a QEHS assistant.
Assistant. What year was that? 1999, 2000. I'm joking. What was it?
1890. it would have been 2000. I want to say 13, but I'm so bad at years. I can never work out in my head. So 2012.
I'm going to say probably 19 and a half, I want to say.
Oh, you are good. That's exactly what I was on.
There you go. Genuinely, I know that that's going to seem really convenient, but I legitimately did not know that. It was just a very good guess.
That's a great guess. I was exactly on that. And we lived in a pub at the time. So me and Sherry used to work in a pub. So we still had the flat there. I'd left and Sherry was still working there, so our rent was dirt cheap. But then when we left there, I think we were paying like 327 a month or something like that for a small one bed flat.
Do you know, it's just crazy how much stuff's changed now, isn't it? I think, again, I'd seen a statistic to say in London that if you wanted I can't tell you what zone this extends out to, but I could have sworn again it was a one bedroom studio type of thing, £2,300 a month. Like, it's just the average cost. I just, jeez, the way he's like, crazy stuff.
And I just felt this week, like, whilst everything that we are talking about is really good, I just felt a country mile away from the life of a small business.
Yeah.
It just felt miles away.
Massively. So many, do you know, it's funny, obviously we've got the upcoming implementation framework, and what I'm about to say next isn't literally meant to be a hard sell or anything like that, but I've loved the conversations we've had about capability, time, quantity, quality, cost, capacity, and culture having such a profound impact on how businesses actually implement things. But as I say, like when I was in my first single site She Advisor job, my budget for the year was like £50,000. But a big chunk of that had to be covered by indirect overheads for the cost of the team. Like that which was basically my salary, right? Now, geez, do you know what I mean? Like, you're talking at a small business that might only be having a tenth of the turnover of that site that I used to work in from a pure revenue point of view. Yeah. They're not going to get £50,000 to spend on a member of staff. Hell, they might have £5,000 worth of stuff. And realistically, even if they're getting consultants in, there's still not only the cost of implementation, but there's a cost of sustaining that implementation as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell you what, James, genuinely, do you think that health and safety consultants should do more for talking about business acumen with their actual kind of SME clients type of thing? Do you think it's our place to even try and contextualize more about what we do in the context of profitability? Look, I'm not saying loss, because like cost avoidance is a classic argument here for why you should do safety, but I'm talking like actually, how do we enhance profitability through what we do?
I think if we want to be relevant in the future, I don't think we have a choice. But like, I think as much as we can, I don't know, it's probably controversial, right? But like, as much as we can walk around and say that health and safety is important, I think we all would agree we don't want to hurt anyone. But the problem is that we think we're not going to hurt. If you get a stuntman and he goes and does this massive jump over a building, he doesn't think he's not going to make it. He thinks he's going to make it. If you get like a boxer and she walks into the ring and she doesn't think she's going to get knocked out, she thinks she's going to win 15 rounds or whatever, right? So my point is, our mindset is that we don't think it's going to go wrong. We think it's going to go right. So when we say health and safety is important, I think we genuinely believe it. Like business owners, I think all of us genuinely believe it. But what we think is that we'll be fine. We have a bias towards it's going to be fine. But profitability of a business is literally what it exists to do and be. Therefore, it's constantly on our mind. So if we want safety to genuinely just be something that's on someone's mind, it needs to be something that's contributing to what a business exists for, which is profitability.
Yeah. Do you know, it's such a good point. I was listening to a podcast. I was just trying to furiously find it then because I can't remember the title properly, but it was an extract from Greg Smith at the Australian World Health and Safety thing earlier on this year. And in it, Greg says that it's our, paraphrasing here, he says it's our responsibility as safety professionals to assume that nothing works. And it's our role to determine the extent of the failure or the degree of success that the processes, structure, management systems, legal frameworks are actually achieving within a given organization at the particular time that we're having a look at it. Yeah. And genuinely, in this day and age where people are expected to be more multi-skilled, especially at a leadership team position in safety, understanding commercial agendas, financial reports, and really trying to help steer conversations about profitability have to fit into that conversation about failure and success. It cannot be siloed. It simply can't for the long-term professional enhancement of health and safety.
Yeah, it is. Well, I could go on forever with this, couldn't you? It's an interesting one. How do you have time? What have you been thinking about this week?
Do you know, I tell you what, a lot of different bits and pieces, to be honest with you. For those who have never heard me kind of speak about this, my brain tends to work a bit like a Rubik's Cube. So if you imagine you're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, you can never look at just one side of the puzzle. You have to kind of look at more of the sides together. If you think you've solved a Rubik's Cube by solving one of the faces, you've not solved the puzzle. You've just solved a part of it. And as soon as one of those other sides move, you've then got to resolve the entire thing again. So where we see health and safety, it's one side of the puzzle. It's one part of this kind of business issue that we need to kind of resolve. So I've been thinking about a load of different things from different podcasts I've been listening to up and down Birmingham and out and about this week. So I've been thinking about blood work following an amazing episode of Speak with Elisa Lynch, Crystal Danbury and Chloe Hughes. I think Chloe might have changed the last name now. Apologies. But Chloe is the global wellbeing lead over at Rolls-Royce and she's previously been on Speak. But it was, again, oh my God, James, every time I listen to Chloe, Lisa and Crystal, I think, good God, I just don't know enough about women. Genuinely, just about women's health, women's physiology, and what that means for effective health and safety in the workplace. So amazing episode from there. There was a great episode that they recently did on the power of advocacy as well. So actually, how do we focus on raising equity within the profession, but raising equity between our peers in health and safety as well. The conversations that happen out of the room, really, but those one-to-ones with other people to raise the profile of others where it's needed and where it's critical. You said you spoke with Prakash earlier on this week. Did you catch his podcast episode he did with Peter Thomas on the My Safety podcast? No. Fantastic. Bit there. Prakash goes into a bit of detail about how he uses an open source large language model to create his construction AI chatbot that he plugs into WhatsApp, Slack, Teams, you name it, everything from that perspective. Some huge food for thought on what that could mean for conversational safety outcomes in especially more mature organizations with a lot of information in their robust safety management systems that people on the front line need to access in a readily accessible kind of way. And there was a really good, on a non-safety point of view, great podcast episode with Ali Abdul. Big fan of Ali Abdul, listened to a lot of his stuff, but it was a deep dive on community building. And it really got me thinking about everything we see in our professional bodies with special interest groups, with branches. And I tell you what, I couldn't help but think just how more effective engaging thousands of people could be if we started to see branches, special interest groups and professional bodies actually take on board more of a community management type of ideal where it's not necessarily about kind of delivering what in a top-down way. It's much more of kind of a grassroots level of engagement, similar to what Huel did when they started with Huelligans, where you kind of create 100 really engaged and empowered customers that become advocates for your brand. I mean, it's what we need, but we don't need safety people to be our advocates. We need the operations managers, the supply chain managers, the procurement guys, HR, all of that part of the world engaging with safety messages. And actually, how can community unlock that potential and unlock that power? So yeah, just a couple of things this week. Not much. How about yourself, mate?
Not much at all, mate.
No.
I've been mostly dominated by just the gap between that SME piece that we were talking about. That's what I've been pondering on all week, really. I'm probably I don't know if I'm similar or not. Like, I'm a bit like a flea. I'll flick from one issue to the other, but then sometimes I'll just be stuck on one thing that I just can't stop thinking about, and I'll just hone in on it for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I've not stopped thinking about whether we're just leaving the main chunk of the economy behind and we're not servicing them. Is how I feel like we're not servicing most of our actual customers, which is small business. And it comes back to what we were talking about with Elisa a while ago around like trickle down safety. And that's really how we're managing a lot of this of stuff. And a lot of what you've just spoke about shows even more complexities within that. Like, so you've now got a potentially a small business that doesn't have access to anyone in safety. And then even safety professionals have things that we're not covering. To your point, like how much do we or don't we know about the women and how the changes and stuff they go through throughout their life and how that affects them and so on. If you have a business that doesn't have access to anyone in that is asking those questions, and they've got no resource, time, or energy just to be able to even think outside the box of those risks and opportunities.
I just
feel like we're leaving them behind. And I feel like all of those things that we're talking about in safety add more complexity, but we're just still leaving them behind, if it makes sense.
I totally agree. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot right for a second here, James. So obviously you are a small business owner, right?
Yeah.
And you're part of business groups, sort of like, not going to say accelerator programs, but literally where a whole bunch of other SMEs come together and you guys talk business, right? You talk, what does it mean to be successful in business? How many times has any of those conversations about being successful in business been through the lens of health and safety or any training, any development, anything? It just isn't, is it? It literally isn't. I mean,
here's the interesting thing about this, right? Is I think what we'll do then is we'll automatically say to make ourselves feel better, that's because they don't care about their people. And that's not what I see. We're in one mastermind group that's trade based, and we're in that as a sponsor. So we go there to help provide advice, basically. So we literally pay to go there. And we give advice for free for two reasons. One, marketing and sales, right? I want to generate leads from there. But the other one is, if they don't come to us, at least they're getting some advice at some point.
Yeah.
So we sit in this mastermind and we give them some advice. So there's that one. So that's a room of anything from big, like I say big business, but they're not like, they would still be like quite small businesses, but big in the world of small, if that makes sense. So like 20 vans on the road kind of. And then we're in a couple of other mastermind groups where I'm a customer or I'm actually there being coached myself, and then another networking group as well. So about three different groups. I don't see a room of people that don't care about their staff. Mm. I see a room of people that constantly talk about looking after their people, that doing the right thing for their people. They just don't connect that to safety. When they do talk about safety, it is compliance that their clients are demanding.
Oh yeah,
that is a conversation of safety. It's not seen as something to look after their staff, because they feel like they're just looking after their staff. If that makes sense.
It would not surprise me if the majority of, and this might be a little bit biased because it's some of the type of SMEs that we deal with, that their only experience of mature safety comes from the content of a PQQ that they have to fill in, that they get sweet fuck all support for once they've actually answered any questions. It's almost infuriating. It feels like it's such a wasted opportunity. And I'm not trying to call out big businesses here by saying, hey, if you issue out a PQQ, you have a duty of care to your tier one or tier two suppliers to help them through health and safety. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that if we really want to see systematic change and improvements through the SMEs across the UK, good God, geez, start with PQQs that actually mean something rather than just being an arbitrary procurement test for ticking a box.
Well, I think it does go further than just... So I think we have this conversation, right? And so one of the keynotes I went to watch literally said, we'll help our subcontractors with their rounds. Ooh, we won't do them for them, but we will help them to make sure that they're good. And it's like, why do we feel like we have to say, we won't do them for them, but we will give them feedback? That's not how they see it. How they see it is they do some rounds, you tear it apart with red pen all over it, and then they go back and they change just the things that you ask. They don't learn anything. They don't get coached or anything like that. But that's not how risk assessment is supposed to be done. That's not how plan, do, check, act, and all of that's supposed to be done. It's supposed to be a collaborative approach. like where we're all going, hey, this is what we're doing. How are we going to do this? How are we managing our risk together? I don't see that, particularly in construction, but really anywhere. Because if we're talking about SMEs, that's pretty much what we're talking about is construction, most of it, because it's just contractor, contractor, contractor. I don't see a collaborative planning approach where we are proactively talking about how we're doing the job and then managing risk and mitigating it. I see a process where they kind of do it, but it's not in a systematic. It's like, let's plan the job to do the job, right? Cool, we've done that. Now let's do all the safety stuff so that we can get over the line and get started. It's like the safety stuff isn't, so they're kind of planning it and doing all of the risk management in a way, but the safety stuff that is not connected to that. It sits outside the compliance process.
I totally agree. And I think that at a fundamental level, it requires us changing the entire concept of being a mature organization who engages with safety. Like, we literally need to change the definition. There was a there's an amazing conversation with James Pomeroy, and he was leading it with Carl Simons from Field and Bridget Leatley, and it was about the Irish Future of Work, what do you call it, big report that had come through. And one of the top things in there for that's it yes that's the one that is the one that you just held up there and one of the, I tell you what, James, do us a favor, if you can, you open up the page on the call to actions, and I want to say it's like page seven or something like that. It's literally, there's like the calls to action, it goes across OHS professionals, businesses, a couple of other different bits and pieces, but we're looking for the call to action for OHS professionals, because that's our audience, right? As part of this today. Have you got it? Yeah. Can you just read out what is the top call to action for an OHS professional?
Here we go. For OHS professionals, deliver change on the ground. The top paragraph is contribute to, support and implement socially sustainable work practices and standards within procurement, across supply chains and in occupational health, safety and health management systems.
Beautiful. And that is an amazing call to action, but fundamentally that is not traditional health and safety. That is societal risk management at that point, in my opinion. And it represents a seismic shift in what we would need to see safety professionals at whatever level they're kind of working out of it as a maturity of a business say, actually, we do need to take more of a societal responsibility to look down the supply chain, elevate those supply chains by asking good questions and making great decisions, but really elevating those that we have chosen to work with. If we can do it, that'd be amazing. But it's so different. It's so radically different, James, from what we've seen so far.
But it is 100%. But the thing that gets me right, it's like, I think what we get worried about in that process of like saying I've got like a roofer, a sparky and a builder that's doing a project and I'm the client. And then there's a PD and a PC, a principal designer and a principal contractor there. And then let's simplify it. Let's not go that's even though CDM, yes, applies to everything before you get funny with me, right? But not you, Peter, but the world of LinkedIn. So let's go with client, simple client and subcontractor relationship. So I'm run a factory and I'm employing a guy just to turn up and do some work for me. That person is good at what they do, but they're not very good at risk assessments, right? They're not very good at writing it down, documenting it, but they're good at what they do and they're right price for us. And we've used them for years, but now I'm the safety professional. I've just got the job and I'm going, hang on a minute. What do you mean Steve doesn't give you any RAMs? We need to get some RAMs.
Yeah.
I think we get bogged down on the legal responsibilities, the legal ownership and duties. And we go, well, it's this Steve's duty to do that and give us some risk assessments. Right. Yeah. Okay. It's not my job to do it for him. I don't get paid for that. Right. But you do get paid to manage the risk of your site and your factory. And Steve's coming in and he's essentially a risk. And I think what we worry about is that if I do Steve's risk assessment for him and something goes wrong, I'm going to be in court and I've taken on those extra liabilities, Probably, yes, you are. But ultimately, if you help Steve do a risk assessment, like him, you're less likely to end up in court in the first fucking place. So I think it's like we get bogged down in the end result instead of just focusing on what we're actually trying to achieve, which is just have a successfully safe job.
So can I call that out for a second? Not to say that it's incorrect, right? But I think it's only half the picture. Because especially where we kind of see the paperwork side of rounds, that's absolutely great. And I think there's a real case there to be saying, right, well, let's actually really support the development of rounds here. But actually, you and I both know that if something happens, the rounds is only half the picture. It's actually the incident at the time that they've done the job and the circumstances in the empirical sense, what's actually happening at the time of that incident. Yeah. And realistically, we can't be there for that type of stuff. There has to be a level of empowered supervision and engagement and ownership of the people that are actually there to live the risk assessment that can make the difference. So I'm not saying that it's incorrect, but
no, it's oversimplified.
Complex. I mean, it's like we've said before, isn't it? Like, it's almost like a model in some respects. All models are wrong, but some are just better than others, right? That's it. So I totally get you, but you've got me thinking. There was so I went to an IOSH Yorkshire branch event with Paul Verrico from Evershed Sutherlands the other day, and he had a kind of a bit in there about the positive impact on educational performance of kids in Africa. And it was saying, okay, what's more effective? Was it giving the kids in Africa English language books so that they can kind of learn a second language? Or was it working through a deworming program to improve the health of the kids? And as you can probably guess, it was a deworming program that had the much more tangible benefit of improving the educational output and outcomes of these kids. So it gets me thinking, you know, when we say, hey, you can do these rounds, we've given you a bunch of guidance. Nice, you're on your way. Is that just the equivalent of giving kids in Africa English books? When in reality, we should be doing more as kind of businesses to be out on the ground, deworming them through, for example, coaching and providing feedback on the physical implementation of the risk assessments that they have written. Food for thought, food for thought. But that is a really cost-intensive program that if we think back, circle back to the whole commercialization piece, who's got the money? Who has the money to do
and
it?
The time.
And the time, exactly. Who's got the capacity to do it? You literally have to build. You'd either have to build a new part of your team to go out and physically do that stuff, or you'd have to contract it out and work through that way.
Tech's got to be a solution here, though. Like, if tech make things quicker and easier, then 100% that's got to be something that we're looking at. And I'm not just saying that because we have Rams Tech, but like, I'm thinking of like, spent nearly a whole week with Cam Stevens. I have no choice but to think about tech.
Cam Stevens is literally the, I'm going to say, a guru, right, behind this. And I don't use that phrase lightly, but yeah. There's got to be something. It's surely something in his bank of knowledge that could work here for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a whole other conversation there, but I'm conscious of time and we want to keep this concise and moving on. So I'm going to randomly pick a question. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go with my friend Terry Considine. By way, as an apology of not getting to his stand, I did go twice, but we kept missing each other. Terry is from he's a consultant himself. So he runs Safe-T Consulting, Safe-T Consulting. He's also based in Northamptonshire. He's done a bit of work for us and with us. He's a good guy, knows what he's talking about. And his question is, I want more accountability. And that starts with occupational safety and health professionals. Whilst we're in the field, in a field of come as you wish, so long as you A, don't give me any bad news, and B, are cheap as chips, more regulation of health and safety advisors, but the established institutions don't seem to want to rock the boat. Whew, we got 20 minutes to nail that one. Okay, so basically he wants... more said, accountability. Come as you are.
More accountability in occupational health and safety. Come as you are with no bad news. And what was the other part of that?
And the cheapest chips.
Cheapest
more
chips,
regulation
yeah.
of health and safety advisors. But the established institutions don't seem to want to rock the boat. So I think he's alluding to, like, do we become like a regulated profession? He's also alluding to a bit of a race to the bottom for consultants that I touched on earlier. Kind of come as you are, but fit within the mold kind of thing as well. But institutions don't want to question. What a question. It's a very Terry question. I like it.
Okay.
I feel like it would be best discussed over some real ale in a lovely pub in Northampton.
Gotcha. Now, no. It's just that there's a lot to unpack, right? As part of that, a lot to unpack. And there's a lot that it alludes to as well. Like, without wanting to be controversial here, is health and safety a profession in the first place? You know, not to take kind of a Simon Cassin approach to this, to kind of deconstruct the question itself. But, you know, I think that there's two sides of the camp. One says, well, we can't be a profession in the same vein that it's not like a doctor type of thing. We don't do a Hippocratic oath to safety at the very start, and that becomes our guiding light as part of things. Yes, some organisations have a charter that you must stick to, but being a member of those organisations isn't a prerequisite for being a health and safety professional in that respect. So I can see where the need potentially for saying, all right, do we need to become a regulated health and safety profession comes from. But wow, what's your knee-jerk thoughts, James? What are you thinking?
Well, I've touched on this before, in that I do think the profession needs to take a little bit more accountability, and we've spoke about this not so long ago on a podcast. And I think we misunderstand accountability. I have also touched on the, I think on Rerun and Safety, whether we should be a regulated profession. We have also covered in a very, very back in the day, you were talking about communities. Back in the day, we had a lovely community in Project Millennium, and this was one of the philosophical discussions that Simon Cassin facilitated for us. Are we a profession?
It very much was.
And he used, I believe, these five premises as to frame our conversation. To be a profession, you have to have a specialized knowledge, basically, based around that topic. It has to be based on scientific methods, and there has to be an application of theoretical knowledge in the practical field. This seems slightly different from what we discussed, but we'll go with this one anyway. Elevation of services through intellectual and personal qualities, autonomy, professional growth, and economic security. Of those five things, they're not the ones we discussed with Simon.
No, they're not. But to play devil's advocate for a second, again, I want to stress there's a bunch of different memberships that someone can sign up for with health and safety. I'm not going to go through them all here, but certainly some of them have, as I say, charters that you sign up to, requirements for professional development, upkeeping, requirements. I say requirements quite loosely because some of them won't necessarily kick you out if you haven't done CPD. Some of them won't kick you out if you haven't done like a self-assessment on your skills services, if you haven't done, for example, like a course on ethics, anything like that. There's more that I see that's been slowly kind of drip fed into it, but it doesn't solve the key thing, which is to say that it's all optional in the first place. You don't even have to be a member. You don't even have to be part of that membership body in the first place. You know, I tell you what, do you think that we would benefit from having something like a CSCS card scheme or something? I know that has its own kind of thing, but
no,
if we're saying regulated, what would a regulated picture even look like here?
I don't know, because for me, those things just become commercial things that just they stop being about what they're intended to do, and they just become things to generate more money. I think we've seen it in CSCS cards, where actually I genuinely don't think that makes any difference. I mean, they've been around for over a decade. Construction has not got any safer, I don't think, in a decade, statistically speaking. I think we've seen the same in SSIP, where a great idea, I think from its original source, is a great idea. In the world of an SME, it's nothing but a pain in the ass, and it achieves very little from a point of creating a safer environment. So what are our outcomes? What are our desired outcomes versus our outputs? Our outputs are badges and cards, but our outcomes, are they safer environments? I'm not 100% sure.
So let's take that kind of outcome bit here and apply it to the first part of the question. Bring, or basically kind of make accountability greater in occupational health and safety. The question is, where should that accountability lie, or who's best placed for it? Is it a third party overwatching organization? Is it the HSE? Or actually, should it be self-regulation, self-accountability, where we strike ourselves off? Or should it be the customer, the client?
So I think we need to probably, again, we're going to run into like a CASIN. I'm going to do a CASIN on you now, right? First, we have to define accountability. Because for me, when we have these conversations, I think we think when we say our accountability is like punishing someone for not upholding the standards of the profession. So we take legal action, right? That, for me, is not accountability. That for me is culpability. So how culpable are you for your behaviors? Accountability for me is the profession just holding the fucking hand up and just going, hey, this is not very good, and I did that, but I want to fix that. If I talk to a customer, and we're talking about this whole blame and accountability thing and culpability, like, oh, I need to hold someone to account, I'm like, you can't hold someone to account. They can hold themselves to account. You can define the standard and they can hold themselves to account. But what you can do is define whether someone is culpable for not adhering to those standards, because that's your right as a business owner. You break a rule, you think that rule is, regardless of the context, you might go, I don't give a shit, Peter's broke the rule, he goes. Fine, you're allowed to do that. You're a business owner or you're a manager, you can do that, right? You break a rule, you run the risk. Accountability is the forklift truck driver getting off and going, shit, my bad, peeps, I'm really sorry about that, and getting involved in the conversation to improve it. For me, that's accountability. And I would like to see more of that for the sake of it.
But I'd say that you really touched on way more about integrity. And I'm not saying that the two are mutually exclusive here. I think that they are really tied together. But where we have high levels of accountability and integrity in occupational health and safety, usually we would never see those publicly shared, because at the time when accountability and integrity is needed most, there's probably a metric shit ton of liability that's going to be attached to it.
Yeah, true.
And as a result of that, because of the nature of what we do, I don't know if we'll ever see it. I don't know if we'll ever. A part of that, it's a classic example. How many times do we see case studies from successful implementation of health and safety initiatives, just generally speaking? Because I think we see hardly any that come out where someone said, hey, we had this really big legal, moral or financial issue to do with health and safety. Here's how we weren't compliant. And then here's what we did to become compliant. It's just, this just doesn't exist. It just, and I get why, but at the same time, we talk a lot about aviation when they've got all the hazards and near miss registers, and how there's a really beautiful level of, on paper at least, open conversations about what can go wrong and what needs to be done to fix it. But there's nothing like that for health and safety. I can't go in a repository right now and say, cool, let's have a look at all of the serious near misses and hazards that have happened in manufacturing or in agriculture. I can't do it. There's nothing. There's literally nothing. So, I mean, do we need to change the entire system? Do we need to literally break the entire thing down and say, actually, for the good of literally everyone here, the whole profession doesn't need to be more accountable. It doesn't need to have more integrity. It just needs to be way more transparent without the risk of being prosecuted or have your share price tank, which I guess is going to be very difficult to do, through sharing something bad that's happened that you've made good, or something good that you've done that you've made amazing. Here's how other people should do it if you follow ABC.
It's a problem that like, because like the body that regulates the profession per se, we're not a regulated profession, but the body that...
Are we going to say which one that is? Are we alluding to the... Okay, right. So in the context of the globe, there are many different regulators for health.
So not just in the UK, like all of them, right? Because we literally were talking about the professional bodies within safety around the world with Cam and Stuart, whereas they were talking about a lot of the frustrations the safety profession has with the professional body in the UK are echoed in Australia and in America. And Cam said, I'll go around the world, and everyone says the same thing about their professional body. Now, I can't speak much for the ones around the world because I've lived a very sheltered life. I can only speak to the UK. But I assume they're all very similar. Is it the second they become a commercial entity in a way that they take sponsorships or things like that, is that when it becomes different? So should it not be a professional body? It should be a government-regulated body in a way that the HSE don't take sponsorships. They need to not get their revenue from other means. The problem is that the problem I'm saying a lot of words and not making much sense, right? So if you have a membership organization, it's really hard. Having tried to build one myself and not come very well, it's nearly impossible to make enough money to cover the costs, because as you grow, the work expands exponentially, but the revenue doesn't expand. So you have to look for forms of revenue in sponsorship by being commercial. So I'm not saying they should stop being commercial, because they can't stop being commercial. But my point is, there's a trade-off that because they're commercial, we can't to Terry's final point was the institution don't want to rock the boat because they can't rock the boat.
I agree. I think that that's actually probably a very fair assessment of it. I'm sure that my degree was in environmental health. I spent 4 years doing my degree, and I started pre-austerity. And genuinely, when austerity hit in the UK, we saw a big shift on the narrative going from education to leaning more toward enforcement. And over the last 14 years or so, I've seen education become eroded at the, it's not even an expense, because it's at the profit generation of enforcement, because that's where the regulators, that's where a lot of local authorities are being pushed into, because there just isn't the money to do anything else. And it comes back to what we were saying at the start, where actually highly mature organizations should be looking at societal risk management rather than reactive risk assessment or reactive activities. It should be way more proactive in terms of that societal thing. And I think you actually alluded to it at the very beginning when you talked about some businesses being like the size of small cities. Christ, at some point, literally the UK is just one big business, right? It is literally one big business that we all happen to work between. So, you know, the highest levels, I think what we're really saying here, James, is that to empower the institutes globally to take ownership and to improve accountability and to stop racing for the bottom, we need to see a seismic or paradigm shift toward global government's approach to societal risk management, improve education, improve engagement, improve the deworming for health and safety, and actually make some bloody tangible changes along the way that are supported by strong funding.
Do you know what I find interesting about this, right, is that
Go on.
And this is something that I used to say quite a lot, actually, but I haven't said it for a while. I think that we don't change because we think someone else will tell us to change. So, like, change is like a risk, right? Particularly when we're talking about this type of change, which is, like, huge. You know, we're talking about completely, really changing the way that we, as a profession, are and exist in a sense. And I think, and I always use this really crap analogy of which to, I now start to question myself whether it's actually true, but let's just go with it in case it is true, right? In that Barack Obama, in his earlier, I'm pretty sure I got it from one of Matthew Syed's books, but anyway, they didn't support gay marriage in America when he came into power, right? But yet legalized it within his term. So he legalized it, yet when he came into power, he didn't support it. When did he change? He changed when the polls said the society supported it. So it was society that made the decision that enabled him to change. I think we think that power, positions of power, make change. It's not. It's the mob, right? As they call it in Gladiator, right? It's the people, it's society that drives change. So Carsten Busch does this really, really interesting little question about the same kind of topic. Is it power or people that drive change? Ultimately, it's both can drive change. Power has the resource and the power to do it probably quicker and to actually make the change. But ultimately, the people, society, still drive change. It's just a lot slower. But I think it's more lasting. So to tie that in a loop, what I'm saying is, if the profession is going to be what I would say is accountable, right, we can drive change by being accountable and stop accepting just shit that we don't think is right and stop doing it. Like if we think, oh, I'm doing this thing and I think it's shit and I hate that we do it, stop fucking doing it.
Yeah, that is a really good point. A really, really good point. And I agree. I think a lot of that is underpinned by three things. It's our ability to critically think, our ability to manage conflict, and our ability to give feedback. And as a profession, genuinely, I think if we want to see a lot of those changes, if we can literally just nail these three skills, nothing necessarily to do with safety, but if we can nail these three skills, the quality of the conversations, the quality of the disagreements, the quality of articulating integrity and accountability will improve so much, or at least have the capacity to improve so much, that we will vastly speed up the level of quality throughout the profession globally. I genuinely do. And that might sound really simplistic rhetoric, just focusing on conflict, feedback, and critical thinking. But does it really have to be more complicated to improve accountability?
No. And I think that the I love all three of those. And you've said them several times since we've been working together. And I love them. But critical thinking for me is just like, I didn't even know what it was. I never critically think like you've critically thought. Critically thought like years ago, and probably only really in the last few years since doing this podcast, really, where I've had to start thinking about it because I'm having conversations with guests or whatever. I'm being like, oh, right, okay, I have to think about that and then try and challenge it or try and ponder it and give my thoughts on it. But to be able to do that, I had to be comfortable with conflict, which is part of conflict management, and accept that you're going to get in a situation where it's comfortable. And I find Joe Rogan is phenomenal at this, right? If you just listen to Joe Rogan, and knows that in his podcast, he has challenged friends and said, you need to give up your career in fighting. You need to like, and he challenges big topics. He got himself in trouble. Like he's got himself really unpopular because he's just comfortable to, he's comfortable in conflict. And I think that's really, really important, which made me reflect on something that happened to us at the Birmingham show, right? So we had a complaint made against us. And in the moment, it was quite emotionally reacted to from myself, right? So a complaint was made. I was like, where and how and when we were making a video. And at first I was like, oh, get fucked. Like, I'm allowed to record here, blah, blah, blah. Right. And I kind of have reflected on it a couple of times over the last day or so and thought, do you know what, like, I'm doing me and you're doing you. Those two values and aims and outcomes may not align, and therefore complaints and conflict would happen, right? That doesn't make either of us right or wrong. It just means that where there's a conflict of paths, there's nothing wrong with it. We just have to be comfortable with it and go, all right, cool, thanks for your complaint. I'm not going to change being me because I don't want to, and that's my values. And you ain't going to change being you because you don't want to, and that's your values. Cool. We'll just fucking coexist. And Simon Casson finished his panel with exactly that thing. When we talk about values and stuff, and he was like, the question is not about finding values that align. The question is about asking yourself whether you can exist with that person's values and your person's values, even though they're different.
Yeah. And that genuinely, I absolutely love it. And that genuinely fed into so much of the mindset that I had listening to Crystal and Elisa's podcast, all about advocacy and allyship as well. Having the confidence and the capability to challenge the values of another person or another group or a team of people to stand up for those who need it, to raise equity, to raise conversations about equality where it's needed, and to basically push against a status quo or find compromise, or even in some cases adapt your mindset to fit in to the needs of the audience that you're engaging with. James, oh my God. What?
I really enjoyed that conversation. We've gone 1 minute over an hour. We're going to have to nip it in the bud. I really like that little structure, actually. I think that worked quite well. I think we covered a lot. We've had some really good conversations. A couple of things I wanted to nail out. Does this mean we're going to stop having guests? If we do this every week, does this mean we're going to stop having guests? No, it doesn't. We've got a lot of content that we got from the Birmingham show, which we're still going to put out as podcasts. We're still going to put out the YouTube channel. I think what this means is this just makes gives us regular content. If we do something like this, this is the regular show. But this show stays consistent. We can still hopefully have more interviews and more broader conversation, produce more content, but easier and more streamlined, which I think is good. So the interviews will be bigger, I think, because this show is the consistent one that I sit on.
Very true. And I want to probably stress as well, this show will probably be less edited, I reckon, than some of the interviews are, where we can kind of go back and forth with some different bits and the conversations can be quite long. We need to keep them a bit condensed. But yeah, I reckon sticking to this format, bit more unedited, bit more off the cuff, so to speak.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed this conversation.
Original source, that's what it was back in the day. Turn the mic on, chat some shit, press play, upload, done. Let's bring it back to its roots. That's what made it successful. And I think we can talk about what we do and then ponder a little bit on some topics, use a question from the community and the audience. I think that's really cool. Wicked. Anything else? Any other updates?
I tell you what, I'm just well excited to get the content out from the event, health and safety event. I cannot wait to see those videos and listen to some of the extracts through. Proper mint.
We chose two questions from the comments, which is where we're. So basically, we put a post up saying what are the big questions. We had 22 comments on that. Two of them weren't comments; they were just comments. The rest of them were questions. So we've got 20 questions that we can go through in here. Two of them we used in a video. So one of them was from the legendary Dave C, who was about safety as a prefix. Sorry, Peter, go on.
I was going to say it was combined with Alan Woodridge as well, sort of like a hybrid between Dave C. and Alan Woodridge.
Nice one. So I'll read out Dave's, you read out Alan. So Dave's was, how does using safety as a prefix or an adjective make whatever follows any different or special rather than myopic and moronic? We chose to leave that Alan,
that we did. So we kind of sort of segmented that with Alan Woodridge's, which is, why do we use the word safety or safe when really we're dealing with risk and capacity? Are people led into a falsehood by the term? Is it time to lose the term in all our communications? So we kind of mixed those two questions up together to really ask if safety needs to have the safety prefix. Actually, is that representative of what we're actually doing?
awesome. And then the other question that we did in the videos, which, like Peter said, will be coming out, was from the president of Irish himself and the head of health and safety at Mercedes, AMG Petronas Formula One. Wow, that's a title.
It is a mouthful.
if this year's on...
card, it's literally like a foot long. It's great.
It's like a, like when you have a magician,
coming out. Yeah, literally, that's it.
Fuck it now. From Stuart Hughes himself, if 50 years on, Robins did his report today, what do you think would be his most interesting / radical recommendation? So we asked around 8 people, I think, that those two questions, maybe more, maybe less. We're going to make one video with kind of bits of all of it. And then what we're probably going to do is put out individually everyone's individual responses, so you can hear everyone's full response. And then what I'm going to do is probably make a shorter video of clipping everyone's things. And then we've also got some recorded like clips of keynotes, which I think me and you are going to try, if we find some time, make a video about those keynotes and then use shots of that overlaid our discussion about it. So yeah, lots and lots of I've just noticed that Dave sees it, someone must have replied to him, and then all I can see is him saying, block me if you can't see past my tone. That's like fucking hell. Anyway. Just like, if you want to find someone who's comfortable with conflict, Dave C himself. lots and lots of content coming from the last 2 days. And then we're going to have lots of content coming out of Berlin as well. So hopefully this is the comeback of Rebranding Safety. Everyone who's stuck with us over the last 2 years where we've been quiet, I appreciate your patience, and hopefully we can be back to our full form.
Very true. Let us know what you think of this new structure. Let us know if you've got any questions you want to pitch to us as well. Yeah, we have a laundry list, but to be honest with you, give us your questions. Let's see if we can get some of these in, because we might end up doing kind of a quick fire, rapid fire dozen questions in an episode at some point. Try and just get some really good answers out and try and answer as many of these as we can. But there is no such thing as a stupid question. And I tell you what, don't be the change you want to see. Be the safety anarchist you want to be. Right? And ask us the questions that you want to do.
Also, don't have to be big, like, change the world questions either. If it's like genuinely a technical question, being like a broken collarbone, riddle or not, like, mate, I would quite enjoy a little question like that, if I'm honest. But yeah, so send them in. I was DM Peter on LinkedIn, DM me on LinkedIn, email either one of us, James or Peter at riskfluentltd.com. And just send us a question. We'll add it. I think what I might do is take all of these questions, put them in a fucking spreadsheet or something. Otherwise, I'm not going through LinkedIn.
Good shout.
So I might do something like that. But yeah, thank you very much, everyone, for your time. And I'll catch you next week. Safe.
Cool. See you. Bye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only, based on limited and dated open source information, and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.